Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
I'm sure if one looks ahead, maybe 10, 15, 20 years into the future, a possible quiz question might be, what awesome texts features The Hunters in the Snow by Bruegel, The Circus by Georges Seurat, and indeed the wonderful works of John Tenniel's Through the Looking Glass and What Alice Found There. A cryptic clue? Not really. It's The Joy of Mementicon, the latest awesome text from the fabulous writer Andrew Caldicott, who is with us now on the Midweek Drive. How are you, Andrew?
Good evening, Alex. Nice to talk to you. I'm fine, thank you very much. A bit boiling, but apart from that, I'm fine.
Well, this could be the end of the planet as we know it. It could be a whole range of things. We might be heading into domes. We might be going into Gentech, and all manner of wonderful things could be happening, or perhaps not. You are obviously a qualified barrister. You are legally trained, which is something you share in common with our other colleague who's joining us, of course, at the Literary Festival at Newark. That's Adrian Tchaikovsky. But share with us initially, in terms of Mementicon, the first of a duology that's planned from that point of view, I've got to say it's pretty much unputdownable. From the opening lines from Fogg and his experiences then, to the way that the pace picks up and the interaction and the whole experience of Mementicon, I found it fascinating and gripping and, to use a cliche, a classic page-turner. So what, in a sense, Andrew, drew you into this field, which in a sense, it's speculative fiction. It's got lots of fantasy elements in there. And I have to say, in certain ways, I felt it was almost channeling some elements of Peake's Gormenghast in places.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, if you spend your life, as I do, in courtrooms, trying to be forensic with real facts, it's lovely to do a different kind of advocacy. And after all, writing is a form of advocacy, where you invent the facts and where the facts are to some degree abnormal. Because I do the law with sort of everyday disputes, it's rather nice to create a new world where the facts are less immediate and more bizarre, but they still have to be, and I think this is the hallmark of really good speculative fiction, they have to be coherent. The world has to fit together, otherwise the whole thing falls apart. And that's the interesting thing between that and a legal narrative, where you're trying to present a case to a judge or a jury and to persuade them that it's convincing, however strange it might sound sometimes.
Well, certainly anyone who in the first decade of the 21st century can actually be named Defamation and Privacy Silk of the Year in 2005, 2007 and 2009 clearly has actually got their legal chops sorted out, which is very important. So congratulations again, retrospectively, for that. But let's move on slightly to this whole notion and this often vexed question of fantasy, science fiction, and other areas related to that. I mean, the sense that I'm getting really, in a sense, had I not realised that you were an Eton College graduate, a New College Oxford graduate, I would have sensed that there were certain elements there that were very much coming into areas of the cryptic, areas of the unusual, areas in many ways of perhaps the British sense of the weird. In fact, obviously, the rather weird book series, rather weird Wintertide and Lost Acre, very much addresses those particular areas. Has that been something you were always fascinated by? Was it something that, in a sense, when you were reading science fiction fantasy in days gone by, you kind of were drawn more to that? Or was it simply a case of, well, it's hard science fiction is all well and good, but I'll leave that to the likes of Stephen Baxter and Adrian Tchaikovsky.
Yes, I mean, I'm not a distinguished scientist. I don't have the scientific gifts to write what you might call hard science fiction. I've actually started reading one of Adrian's books. I'm much enjoying it, but I would find filling in a world with all this, the technical stuff you need, I would find that very challenging. But you're right to say that I have always been attracted by what some people call English strange. And funny enough, Alice is one of the very first books that I read, semi-grown-up books, and it is an extremely odd book. Mm. And although you think the characters are completely bizarre when you're young. As you grow older, actually, you recognize a lot of people who fit one or other of them. You know, you find bossy red queens, eccentric white knights, charming, you know, the old white queen, all these people, you begin to recognize types. So I think it is strange, but it's coherent. And Mervyn Peake's world also, I think, is coherent, although very strange. And I read those books when I was in my sort of mid-teens and was very influenced by them. He, of course, could draw very well. And I think he visualized, had that advantage of being able to visualize his world in that way on the paper, which I can't.
Well, I have to say, certainly the little fragments of drawings that do actually appear within Momenticon are quite fascinating in terms of the way that they, we're back to the classic notion of à la recherche de temps perdu, in remembrance of things past. Marcel Proust's sort of line of, you just get a fragment and it opens up a whole new world and a whole new era. And I was also very pleased, Andrew, that you avoided the temptation to take what I would refer to as a Terry Pratchett-esque left turn into farce at times. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with Terry Pratchett, God rest his soul, he's done wonderful material in all sorts of ways, but I did feel as though the reader, when they're introduced to the world, our world, of course, within Momenticon, very much has that internal consistency and logic that follows through with it, even though the descriptions and the ways in which our characters interact with the mind and so on does tend to obviously stretch that boundary. I mean, it's very much almost a case of the mind expansion area within the whole thing. And indeed, obviously, that's how we're introduced to the first character. He's given this pill. Does he take it? Does he not take it? And then, of course, it all literally moves on from there. Was that something, again, that in terms of influences you were thinking, again, was there an Alice-esque notion of that insofar as, was it the equivalent of the Drink Me bottle?
But it's quite interesting. I mean, I'm not sure I intended it or saw that, but a number of the online reviews have talked about going down the rabbit hole. And I have to say, I can't say that I intended that, but I can see now that it is a bit like that. It is a passport to this very strange world, except, of course, in Momenticon, people go in and out of these pictures. They're not in there all the time. And it becomes a travelling device as well, later, particularly in the sequel.
Yeah. I mean, the other aspect which also sort of struck me initially, and I just wonder whether this had some kind of background influence somewhere, was, of course, the classic character of Cole Hawlings in Box of Delights, where, of course, again, he escapes from the villains by actually literally moving into the picture, into the image.
Yes, I did read John Masefield again in those early years, and I thought the Box of Delights, although uneven, is actually a wonderful story. And the Midnight Folk is quite good too, but the Box of Delights is a bit harder and a bit stranger. Do you remember the wolves running?
Absolutely. We had to sort of keep ahead of those wolves and the whole system, and all to save Christmas, which is very good, really. No spoilers there, but it's just a line from that point of view. Clearly, again, thoroughly enjoy the text, and I keep coming back to this. I mean, there's so much to actually develop. In fact, I'd almost say, one, as a reader, you almost need to slow down the pace of consumption so you begin to savour the way in which the framing is actually put together for this. Did you have any particular favourite characters that you liked? I mean, were you secretly admiring the joys of Cosmo or Lord Vane, or was it a case of, no, actually, they were all simply ciphers to the cause?
I mean, it's a point you were making, interesting point you were making earlier about humour and its role. And I always think that if your horror is going to be horrific, you need a bit of humour as well. So, in other words, if your background is uniformly dark, when darkness comes, it doesn't have the same impact. Does that make sense? And therefore, I mean, I do rather enjoy writing villains. And Cosmo Vane is a pretty unpleasant character.
Yeah, he's not nice. I mean, really, from the off, you kind of get the feeling that you wouldn't warm to him. I mean, I'm always tempted to say that in certain instances he could be played quite nicely by Johnny Depp, but maybe that's a different line entirely.
Yes, indeed, he could. Former client of mine, so perhaps I could call a favour in.
Exactly. I mean, certainly, as I say, the whole process works well. And just setting the scene, I mean, again, for the benefit of the listener who sort of, obviously, you will be signing up, dear listener, immediately for Friday the 8th of July for the wonderful Andrew Caldicott and Adrian Tchaikovsky at 2 p.m. At the Tudor Hall at the National Civil War Centre in Newark. But in terms of that, is it a post-apocalyptic world that we've actually said? I mean, clearly there's been a major impact on the climate. And is that development between the two agencies, the Jenrich and, of course, Tempestus, was that something you kind of had in mind of saying, OK, well, let's use that wonderful device of what would happen if, and what would happen if you did actually have this development between, obviously, the mind inner space and, of course, the external space, and, of course, ensuring that within the human spirit, there's still a tendency for survival, although it's interesting that, rather like Orwell would have said in terms of Animal Farm, some citizens are more equal than others, shall we say, in the Manticon world, it would seem.
It's not a sort of hand-wringing dystopian book. I mean, it's not about the horrors of having to survive. But it is about, I think, what would we cling to if nature was lost? On the other point you raised, I think one advantage to a writer of a dystopian setting is that it clears a lot of clutter, so you can have just two rival organizations really controlling everything and representing different values. And of course, those organizations change as their leadership changes. And this you will see more of in the second volume. I mean, Cosmo Vane's father was a fairly decent man, but it goes very wrong when he's succeeded by, I won't give any spoilers away, but what appears to be his son.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's a simplifier, a dystopian world. You haven't got the clutter of the real world in the way. So you can set up new rivalries, which is quite stimulating, I think.
Acid rain was what sprang to mind when we talked about the lethal smog and obviously the benefits of, or indeed the use of chitin, that's a traditional protector of many insects. I mean, there was the old notion, of course, that in the event of a nuclear catastrophe, it would be the cockroach that would survive, because pretty much the cockroach is as near as darn it, invincible because of its chitin and so on. Was that something else you kind of were channeling in terms of the description of how the domes were protected, if, yes, of course, you were allowed to be protected?
Yeah, that was indeed intended. And I've actually, funny enough, it's something I noticed that Adrian's very interested in. He's very interested in the insect world. Although I don't know, I suspect, anything like as much as he does, I've always been quite interested in it. And there are, for example, quite a lot of moths who are highly poisonous to birds, so they and their caterpillars don't get eaten.
Indeed.
And chitin, or chitin, however you pronounce it, it is an extraordinary material, this sort of exoskeleton. It's a very remarkable thing. And it just struck me as having a sort of plausible feel to it, while being, of course, highly improbable.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting, returning to Adrian's work, of course, the Children of Time series. Not only do we have the accelerated evolution of spiders and arachnids and so on, but also cephalopods in the scenario. So you've also got the growth there of the octopus and areas with respect to that. I do know Adrian, I've spoken to him several times about this, is again quite taken with that. Alternate forms of intelligence that maybe we as mere human beings don't actually realise in their own way have got a sophisticated a format of existence as we do, and given other alternate realities could well develop and evolve in their own peculiar ways.
Yes. I mean, I've always wondered about a lot of orthodox religion rather places mankind higher than everything else. I've always had my doubts about whether that's really... not done some harm.
Let's face it, Andrew, when Nicholas Copernicus decided to daringly suggest that maybe the Earth revolved around the Sun as opposed to the Sun revolving around the Earth, it took quite some time for that to actually to gain purchase. And Galileo obviously had to suffer as well from that point of view, but that's another issue entirely. So as I think to quote Douglas Adams in one of his lines for Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, if ever anybody did actually figure out the universe, it would instantly collapse and be replaced by something much more complicated. Maybe it's just a thought. Let's talk a little bit about the writing process now. I mean, are you a disciplined writer insofar as do you effectively set yourself specific targets to say, okay, I'm going to write at least 2,000 words today, and I'm not going to actually leave this particular computer or laptop or whatever writing instrument you're actually using until that's actually done? Or is it a case of you wait until the muse takes hold?
It's a bit of, it's neither really. Because of the day job, I certainly can't have an orderly writing day, and I never do. And nor equally can I really wait until the muse comes. So what I try to do is to write in the early morning before I get into chambers, quite often in a coffee shop. That's not original, I know, but that's how I do it. And I just hope it comes, you know. Sometimes you think it's wonderful, you look at it the following day and it's crap. And sometimes it works. But sometimes there's something in it worth preserving, but lots isn't. And it is very odd, this question of having a day when suddenly what you write is good, because there are plenty of days when it's not. And you have to be quite ruthless, I think, about the pruning.
Well, it's what somebody once said, you have to kill your babies to actually ensure that the thing develops in the way that you wish to encourage the reader to work through. The New York Book Festival is obviously interweaving both the written word, the spoken word, and of course the musical concept as well from this point of view. Many writers these days, I'm finding, tend to have their playlists without which they feel as though their creativity eludes them. And I'm just wondering if whilst writing in a particular coffee shop early in the morning, do you actually have a series of musical items that you feel, yes, well, unless I actually have at least a dash of Prokofiev or a smidgen of Paul McCartney, or maybe some Jean-Michel Jarre, and frankly, life isn't worth living?
Well, I am a great Shazammer, so you're right there. But I'll give your listeners a composer I discovered completely by coincidence, oddly enough, when in Las Vegas, sitting around doing a bit of scribbling, and no one has ever heard of him, or hardly anybody. He's called Stasius Muller. And he wrote some piano pieces called Antillean Dances. And I particularly recommend, there's a wonderful one called Chichubi. They're quite sort of, they're very syncopated. They're quite like a sort of modernist Joplin, but I really recommend them. It's nice to hear something which you really do not know at all, a genre you don't know. You know, friends sometimes obviously tell you things you don't know, but I think Shazam is a wonderful invention.
An old folk like me,
you know, it's a new discovery, and it's something I couldn't possibly have done when I was a young man. It just wasn't available.
Thank you.
Well, it's the joy of technology and a variety of other elements as well brought to the fore. You've obviously written, as I say, the rather weird series. We know that, etc. I'm interested as well, just mentioning that Higher Than Babel, described as impressive by the Financial Times, a bold debut by the Independent. Just talk us through what Higher Than Babel was about.
That's a good swinging delivery. It starts, you won't believe this, it starts on the top of a tower with a man in a flying suit, wearing a sort of Leonardo da Vinci flying suit, about to try to take off. So this is a very strange play. And we then go to the burning of the books in Nazi Germany in 1933, and an old professor who rescues a book from the fires, you know, from the SS guards round about. And he's a nuclear scientist, and he retires to his house on the Rhine during the Second War. Turns out that this book is the Codex. You know, Leonardo had these wonderful books called Codexes, which had all his drawings and thoughts in. And the book that he's rescued is, in fact, the book of the man we see at the very beginning. And from there, you have two parallel plots. I mean, you were mentioning Galileo, and he's very much that kind of figure wrestling with church and state. Mm. And then you've got the old professor in a fascist state, and his son, in fact, is a sort of Nazi scientist. So there are these conflict of free ideas, and science also as a sort of slave to unpleasant states and the moral questions they raise. So it was quite an ambitious play, but it's great fun. It's a collaborative thing, plays. And then I had a period when I couldn't get anything on, and I got very depressed. And then I thought, well, one of my sons said, well, why not? Why don't you try and write a novel? Huh. And so I jumped ship. And of course, plays are all about words. And then suddenly you do a novel and you realize you can describe. In fact, to start off with, you go slightly berserk with this new paint box. Eventually, I hope I learned to rein myself in a bit.
And of course, there is the classic line of transmedia storytelling that, who knows, I mean, I'm sure that it'll only be a matter of time before Momenticon hits the stage. I mean, it could happen. Momenticon the musical, I'm just saying, it could be a possibility.
All those paintings, yes. Did you ever see the musical when the painting comes to life?
Sunday in the Park with George.
That's it.
Stephen Sondheim. Absolutely. Yeah, really good there. And as I say, that worked on that basis. So I'm sure that Momenticon is the 21st century version waiting to happen. Worth considering. In terms of relaxing, Andrew, let's do a sort of standard cliched interrogative. Is the writing the relaxation? I won't suggest that actually, I prefer my barrister work. That's when I actually sort of relax from that point of view. What are the sort of areas that you work through? Or is there something that, in essence, you'd like to share with us that you're a secret skydiver or indeed lover of Love Island?
No, I'm a very ordinary amateur pianist, so I still play the piano a bit. And I'm very keen on walking. I used to do quite serious walks, the White Mountains in Crete and all those sort of, and the, you know, over the Pyrenees and all that stuff. And I think walking is a really good way. I tend to have my best and most bonkers sort of creative thoughts when on the move. Mm. The writing is a different process. I mean, it's interesting you talk about relaxation, but I think the brain has all these different pylons. And when it gets tired, what it needs to do is to use a different set of pylons. So I'm not sure it's quite relaxing. In my case, it's sort of rerouting.
Yeah.
And the law uses a particular set of rather disciplined, I think, wiring in your brain. Flick a switch and try something slightly more self-indulgent is good for you, I think.
Absolutely, the whole notion of a reboot and a little bit of downtime as well, which I think works tremendously well from that point of view. And as we approach, obviously, the Newark Book Festival, and I'm going to remind you, it's Newark, Nottinghamshire. I know we've had a couple of international listeners who thought, oh, is that Newark, New Jersey? No, Newark, Nottinghamshire. But in terms of the sequence, are you looking forward to the event? Is it something that, I mean, are you a festival person? Or is it a case of, well, there are only a few special ones that I'll actually attend, and this is one of them?
Well, I always accept an invitation I get, but I have done Newark once before and thoroughly enjoyed it. It was an extremely varied audience. The questions were penetrating and I thought very bright. And my fellow people on the platform were equally delightful, and I've not met either of them before. So it was a thoroughly good experience. And I was talking about plays. You know, one thing about putting on a play is it's very collaborative in the moment. What I like about these sort of festivals is that you get to learn a bit more about readers' perspectives, and that readers' perspectives are very important to a writer. Oh. You're not going to agree with all of them, but it's jolly useful to learn, you know, what readers think and how they react and what they find difficult and what they find appealing. It's I think it's a foolish writer who doesn't listen.
It's an interesting connotation of what I refer to as the Bartesian triangle between audience, author, and text. Often, yes. when speaking to students, one kind of addresses this issue. And although sometimes perhaps one feels as though many media outlets tend to spend too much time on focus groups. I think the old line that if John Reith had actually set up focus groups, the BBC would never have actually got into any way, shape or form at all 100 years ago. But in terms of the overall system, I think it is important to actually see the shift between the co-creators, the creators, and the way it actually develops.
Yes, I mean, another interesting question is how much should you ask of your readers? And I think I would accept my books probably ask more of the readers than some. I would say Adrian's ask a bit of the reader as well. I think personally that's a very good thing.
Yeah.
But there is quite a lot of fiction where you really don't have to do anything. You just have to sit back and just let the story, you know, it's often quite linear. I happen to think that causation is quite complex. And that means that your readers have to think a bit and remember a bit and cross-refer a bit. I think that's a good thing, but it's not everybody's cup of tea.
Well, something I'll be probably utilising at the event itself is the old Einstein quote, which I think applies to both your work and indeed Adrian's work, that the one persistent illusion is that past, present and future are somehow separate entities. And I think that there is that notion of actually taking that step into shifting back and forth in terms of narrative, or literally stepping into the image, stepping into the experience, and actually appreciating how the thing develops. I've often said with Adrian, the best way to appreciate Adrian's work, and it certainly merits appreciation, is you need to dive in for the first 100 to 200 pages, really just dive in, keep on going, and then it begins to click. Then it begins to actually start making sense and coherence and working through that. If you dip in and just dip the toe in every so often, you might find it a little bit bamboozling. That's just my own experience.
No, that matches exactly mine, I would say. Exactly mine.
Well, Andrew, it's been tremendous connecting with you, good self, for this little pre-festival interview. A reminder, of course, it is an afternoon little slot between 2 p.m. and 3 p.m. At the Tudor Hall National Civil War Centre at Appleton Gate in Newark. I think tickets are still one or two available, so well worth going for it from that point of view. It's going to be an absolute delight, I know that. But we have two final questions that I need to put to you. They're the kind of standard wrap-up ones for most of these little pieces, certainly for the author of the week scenario. First of all, Adrian, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
I found it really stimulating. I mean, your questions have a load in them, which I think is really good.
Well,
they stimulate an answer rather than simply, you know, the dull question, which has actually, it's like a Trojan horse. You sense there's a bit more in it than just what appears, you know. It's a good thing.
So Thank you, Andrew. That's much appreciated. So the next critical question is, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the not too distant future? Will you be kind enough to return?
Yes, absolutely. Of course I will. Yeah, no, absolutely. And indeed, I'm planning to wind down at the bar a bit to do more writing, because it's quite frustrating having to, and I do have to give, obviously, my legal clients have to have priority. And I'm going to you know, wind down a bit of the bar in order to do more writing, so I shall have more time to come and talk to the likes of your good self, which will be fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
in the 20th century, Kool and the Gang had a hit with Celebrate, Good Times, Come On. And maybe this is one of those years where, despite the cost of living crisis, despite the challenges of war going round, despite the emergence of monkeypox and other successes in terms of health, etc., maybe we do need to actually celebrate and just enjoy the summer of celebration. So let's talk to somebody who's certainly a keen expert when it comes to celebrating. He's an all-round wonderful TV presenter and journalist extraordinaire. It's AD Smith. How are you, AD?
Hello there. I am very well, thank you. I'm enjoying this sunshine. I've got a beautiful chilled glass of Pinot Grigio beside me. It is going well.
Well, this is great. And actually, what you've just said there suggests that you're very much on the nose when it comes to Britain in general being a nation of al fresco diners, with the garden and sunny weather being key favourite occasions to share a glass of wine with friends and loved ones. So no real surprise there, or is there any unusual behaviour in this? I mean, after all, surely after Brexit, we were supposed to be frightfully British and ignore all that kind of European continental whatever.
Well, you'd think so. So I've teamed up with Barefoot Wines to basically unearth and create a survey that has looked at the trends and the beliefs of people when they're hosting their British summer parties. And what we've uncovered is that 46% of people want to host these parties because they just want to get the community together. Another 36% of people want to know their neighbours more. And so what this is showing us is that the era of COVID, where we're all trapped inside and can't see each other, has come to an end. We want to embrace one another. We've had the Jubilee, which has really set things in motion. It's now Pride Month. So basically, everyone just wants to get out there and spread the love.
We've also got, of course, the season of country shows that are re-emerging, with the Lincolnshire Show obviously coming up, the Newark Book Festival, all manner of wonderful things within that whole area. Is it a case of, well, yes, it's all very well having a platinum jubilee, but that only happens once every 70 years. Do you think this is something we need to ensure continues to ripple out and resonate across subsequent generations? We need to acknowledge that celebration is a good thing to do at the offset.
I think so. I think it's all about coming together as a community. And you're right, sometimes we can be kind of typically British and avoid one another, especially when you're on things like the Underground. God forbid you look up and make eye contact with someone. But I think slowly but surely, because of COVID and because we've had these beautiful celebrations put in place, we are now going out there and spending more time with each other. I mean, that's always been Barefoot's philosophy in terms of bring together the community across food, across drink. In fact, one of our stats, 35% of people said that these parties are all about the food, but it can also completely make or break it. If I was to ask you, what do you think is the number one type of food that people have at their British summer parties, what would you say?
Do you know, I'm tempted to actually say something really crass, such as crisps or prawn sandwiches, and neither of those, I'm sure, will be in the list.
Do you know what? Crisps are absolutely on the list. They're in second place, so well done.
Wow, and there we are.
I'm going to give you sandwiches as well, but only if your sandwiches are cut into triangles, because 22% of people said it's all about the triangle sandwiches.
Yeah, you see, I don't know. I've always quite liked the crust. Maybe it's just me, just part and parcel of the whole thing, but that's by the by. I mean, I think, you know, you can go so far with triangle sandwiches. It strikes me as being a bit like insisting that you actually only have your toast in eggy soldiers, which is another entirely debate which we can go into. Let's move into summer party etiquette, though, AD. I mean, what is good practice? I mean, if you turn up, for instance, to Royal Ascot and you're barefoot, that's not good, presumably.
Do you know what? I always say to people, you can do whatever you want as long as you enjoy it. Just do what makes you happy. And that's one thing that, coming out of the COVID era, we've really learned, that let's get away with all this snobbery and all this pretentious thinking. Let's just do what we enjoy and live life. On the party etiquette side of things, 40% of people said the biggest no-no is to not turn up with a form of food or drink, which I completely appreciate, because when I host parties, it's always nice to bring something and contribute, you know, have something on the table that people can explore. 35% of people, and this one's quite funny, actually, 35% of people said they get, you know, party peeved when people snoop through the neighbor's belongings. I've not seen that before. Have you seen that?
No, I must admit, I mean, that is borderline very sociopathic behavior, I think, rather than etiquette, basically. You know, I mean, I can maybe understand curiosity, but that's not necessarily a good thing to actually sort of encourage, really. But
no, it's definitely not. I mean, to be honest, I'd be a bit worried to go through my neighbour's drawers. I don't think I want to do that.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So let's assume that you're on best behaviour. You brought your own bottle. You brought your own accompaniments. You brought maybe even a cake to the party, etc. What would be the perfect drinks to accompany a summer get-together?
Well, this one's easy. I don't need any research here because Barefoot have over 2,000 awards that they've been dished out for their wines. So I'm going to give you four wines that are going to work really well for your British summer party, all of which are £7 from major retailers across the country to make it even easier as well. I'm going to start off with the reds. So I'm going to start off with one called Barefoot Jammy Red. So I want you to think about kind of cherry and raspberry. This is a super fruity wine that is perfect for your barbecues. So steak, lamb, sausages, it's going to work wonders. I've got a Barefoot Malbec, which is going to give you these beautiful notes of ripe plum, dark cherry, a kind of soothing milk chocolate and vanilla. Now, this is my wine when the sun's just gone down, it's coming to the end of the evening, and I want a glass of wine that's going to wrap around my tongue, give me this comforting kind of hug around the palate as well. Are you more of a red or a white fan, may I ask, when it comes to your wine?
You know, I'm probably have to go to say white, if only because of my footballing allegiance. You know, there's something just wrong about going for red wine sometimes.
Ah, well, you're going to love these next two choices then, especially for this weather that we've got outside right now. So I've got my Barefoot White Zinfandel. So this is very much pineapple. It's strawberry. This is going to work wonders when it comes to things like chicken or fish or some grilled halloumi on the barbecue. And my last, but certainly not least, and this is really important to me as someone in the LGBT community as well, the Pinot Grigio from Barefoot, which is going to give you apple and citrus and peach, super fruity. And what they've done for Pride is they basically put the progressive Pride flag on the bottle, which I think is really nice. We're talking about the longest standing supporter in terms of a wine brand with Pride, who've been at the parade since the 1980s. So that's really touching. And one thing that I will mention is completely separate to Pride. The whole notion of bringing together the community is something that Barefoot is really proud to support. And they formed an alliance with the LGBT Foundation and something called the Rainbow Buddies Program. So anyone who's suffering from loneliness or feeling isolated, especially after COVID, they kind of extend a hand and help them be pulled out of this hardship that they're facing. I just think that's really nice and touching.
And the other good news, of course, as you mentioned, that AD was the cost of £7, which even a cost of living crisis is not going to hopefully break the bank. But it's worth sort of noting from that point of view. So we're not talking about 500 bottles or £500 per bottle of wine, shall we say, or even 500 bottles. No, I won't even go there. AD, it's been awesome connecting with your good self. But where can people find out more information about Barefoot?
If you want more information, then barefoot.co.uk. And as I say, £7 at all retailers across the entirety of the UK.
Amy Smith, TV presenter and journalist extraordinaire. Keep on keeping on and happy celebrating.
Cheers.
It's a celebration.
Celebrate good times, come on.
Let's celebrate. There's a party going on right here. A dedication to last throughout the years. So bring your good times and your laughter too. We gon' celebrate and party with you. Come on now. Let's all celebrate and have a good time, yeah, yeah.
Celebration.
We gon' celebrate and have a good time. It's time to come together. It's up to you. What's your pleasure? It's a celebration.
Celebrate good times, come on.
Let's celebrate, come on now.
Celebrate good times, come on.
Let's celebrate. We're gonna have a good time tonight. Let's celebrate, it's alright. We're gonna have a good time tonight. Let's celebrate, it's all right.